Yeah.
So, welcome to the second edition of First Cut. The First Cut is our new expository video lecture series, which is being done under the auspices of the Geometry and Topology RTG, funded by the NSF. So, the videos and slides for these lectures are going to appear on the relevant website, which at least for the moment is www.ma.utexas.edu/geometry. That's liable to change, but that's correct for the moment. So these are expository lectures on topics of interest in geometry and topology aimed at graduate students, postdocs, faculty, and with that, it's a pleasure to introduce speaker Travis Shedlow, who's going to speak about syntactic resolutions.
Right, so this is an introductory lecture. Thank you very much for the invitation, for everybody for coming. I hope that if there's any errors, then you'll tell me about it and the video will be suitably redacted, right? So this is what I'm counting on here. Okay. Or, you know, anything else. State secrets, I don't know what. Okay, so not that I know any of those. So let's look at, let me say something about symplectic resolution. So what am I going to talk about today? So I know this could be a mixed audience here, so I'm going to start out just saying everything that I want to talk about. So I'm going to work over complex numbers, and I'm interested in varieties. So just to make sure, I'm going to apologize that some of this will probably bore some of you, but I just want to make sure that I understand what we're talking about. So an affine variety is, well, there's two different versions you could have, algebraic, which means it's a solution of polynomial equations. F1 equals fm equals 0 and variables, so it's a solution, so as a variety, as a space, it's solutions inside of Cn. It's the variety. All right, so that's an affine variety, and we could also have holomorphic or complex analytic, which is the same thing. That will be, or the Fi are holomorphic functions rather than polynomials. So that's more general, right? All right, so that's what I want to talk about. That's an affine variety and a general variety. I don't want to define it, but it's just it's glued from affine varieties. So those of you who know what that means. So basically what it says is that locally, near every point, X and X, a variety, and U is equal to an open subset, open neighborhood of X, then there exists an affine variety that U is isomorphic to an open set of Y. Y is an affine variety. Right. So that wasn't really precise, but this is not, of course, the subject of my talk. I just want to make sure that everybody understands, no matter where you're coming from, what it is I'm talking about. Okay, so that's what I'm going to talk about. Now, what I want to really talk about is I'm actually interested and singularities of varieties. So you can have and this is going to be our standard, always a standard running example in this business. You could have a cone singularity, x squared. Let me say, UV minus W squared equals 0, maybe plus W squared, doesn't matter, equals 0 in C3, right? So you could have, and there's our singularity there. at zero, right? So I'm interested in singularities of varieties. Notice when I said solutions of polynomial equations, so I'm not saying this is a manifold. I'm not defining variety as a manifold. I'm defining a solutions of equations, therefore there are singularities. So I'm interested in the singularities. Rather than trying to avoid them, I'm interested in them. But there's a nice interplay that's very old in this business, which allows you to interchange singularities for complicated smooth varieties. So there's this thing called resolution of singularities. So one point of view on what is resolution of singularities, it's you can take x going to y, where this is singular. Yeah, I knew that was going to happen. And you just feel free to keep pointing it out to me. So this is a singular variety, right? And then the resolution of singularities, and this will be smooth. This will have some nice properties. I'm going to say what that means in just a second. But basically, the point is that we're going to take these singularities, we're going to make them big in here. So this will have a more complicated global geometry. It's smooth, but it has a complicated global geometry that won't be affine in particular. So it definitely won't be affine. And this one's singular, it could be affine. So usually the cases we'll all be interested in are affine. There's actually lots and lots of interesting cases of resolution of singularities which are not affine. But if you just want to understand the singularity itself and how you've resolved it, you can restrict again to this affine neighborhood. So understanding the affine situation is a lot of the story. But it's, of course, not everything. There's lots of interesting global things. But for us, let's just say for simplicity, this will usually be affine. So now we've had this bargain where we've taken some complicated local structure and replaced it by a complicated global structure. So it's globally simple, because it's just affine, but locally, so if it's affine, then it's locally globally simple, otherwise it's not necessarily. But in any case, it'll be locally complex, locally complicated. I don't want to confuse with the complex numbers. It's locally complicated. But this one will be locally simple. Obviously, anything that's smooth is by definition locally simple. There's nothing going on locally, not in the complex topology. Okay? Any question about that? So that's sort of the general story. Now let me tell you what a resolution of singularities is, if there's no question. So what is a resolution of singularities? And you know, since this talk was called symplectic resolutions, it might have been assumed that you knew it. But let me just say, anyway, definition, a resolution of singularities is a map as above, is a row, so it has to be from something smooth to something singular. Or at least the source has to be smooth. As a row, as above, so that it has to be birational, such that it's birational, which means that row restricts to an isomorphism U isomorphic to V, this sitting inside of X, this sitting inside of Y, where U and V are open and dense. That's what birational will mean. So it's not going to be an isomorphism, obviously, since this is singular and that's smooth, but we want it to be generically an isomorphism. We want it to be at least isomorphic in most of the places. So that'll be birational, and then we'll have proper. And this is just, you know, like in topology, it's the same. In fact, that is what it is. It's saying that row inverse of compact is compact. But in particular, if that sounds not necessarily intuitive to you, a slightly weaker thing, which is definitely following from it, is if you take row inverse of a point, so i.e. a fiber, this is, of course, compact. So all the fibers are compact. This is one nice way to think about it, I think. I like to think of it that way. Okay? So that's the definition of a resolution of singularities. Great.
Perhaps it doesn't matter, but which topology do you want us to think of?
Oh, complex. I'm not talking about Zariski topology. If you know the Zariski topology, which many of you do, that I will not need it for this talk. Zariski topology is really nasty, although it's useful for some things, but I won't need it. Okay, great. So complex topology, just to answer that question. Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to state a well-known theorem in this business that you cannot miss, Hironaka's theorem. For all y is incredible, as long as you know what a variety is, for all y, there exists a resolution. And the importance of this theorem cannot be overstated. I mean, this algebraic geometry is built on this theorem, as far as I understand it. Well, complex algebraic geometry, obviously. And characteristic P, as last I heard Hironaka giving a talk, he's still working on the characteristic P and has some great ideas for it, and maybe other people are working on it too. But so in characteristic P, this theorem is not done, but in characteristic 0, this is Hironaka's famous result, and it's just ubiquitous. Okay. However, so there exists a resolution. This is really, really important and useful. However, it's not unique at all. It's not even close to being unique. And let me give you an example. Well, when y is smooth, there's still many x's. Still, x need not be y. So, e.g., we could take C2, we could blow up a point of C2, where this is an isomorphism over C2, so this is a blow up of the origin. Isomorphism over C2 take away 0, the origin, and then we have P1, the blow up, over 0. Yes, I. Okay. I have this happen to me in my class. You have to forgive me for being slightly annoyed every time I do this, because I used to use my laptop, and then there was not a problem, and then I broke my laptop, and now I've been using the doc cam, and it always happens every time that I go off the page, and I haven't quite gotten used to it. Okay, sorry about that. Okay. So that's the example. So it's not unique in any way. We got a P1 sitting over 0, and we can blow up more points. In fact, this is a very useful operation in algebraic geometry, blowing up points. This is actually an important thing to do. But it, in particular, tells us that this resolution is not unique. Okay, so that's what we have going on with that. And now, I want to say, from the point of view of algebraic geometry, this is useful to blow up, but from the point of view of having a nice theory of resolutions where x and y are sort of on the same footing, What has gone wrong, I'm going to put wrong in parentheses because it really depends on your point of view whether this is a wrong or not. But what has gone wrong is that x was too big, right? We got a P1 over 0, right? So it was too big. Okay. So now I'll give you the... So I promised I was talking about symplectic resolutions, so... Symplectic resolutions are sort of a fix. So one fix, and this is of course not a general fix, maybe it doesn't even need to be fixed in general, but this is a solution to this uniqueness, as I'm going to explain, is to restrict to symplectic resolutions. And the definition of a symplectic resolution is really easy. A resolution of singularities is symplectic. So again, we're always going to use this x to y for this talk, x to y, if x is symplectic. That's it. So you all know what it is, this one thing I'm assuming, but i.e., there x has a non-degenerate closed 2-form, omega. It's a global closed 2-form. If you like, I could write it this way, okay? This is a strong condition on X. So but it's a multi-resolution, it's just that. Okay, so notes. So first of all, I'm going to note that, I'm going to explain to you why this is a solution to the uniqueness problem in a way. But I want to just say that it's not an obvious solution. So first of all, note that rho does not always exist anymore. There's no hope of having any sort of existence. And the most obvious reason is, e.g., if the dimension of y is odd, clearly it's impossible to have a resolution of singularities if y is odd dimension. I mean, all symplectic varieties are even dimensional. But that's sort of dumb. So even if we restrict, so we make the most obvious restriction to y, which are generically symplectic. So I think the most obvious restriction, which is already quite a stringent one, is to say that y is generically symplectic. So say that on some open dense subset you have such a form, omega, but maybe not on the whole thing. Okay? Okay, so but even if we restrict to that, it doesn't always exist. So I'm going to discuss this a bit. Okay, so this is a problem. But rather than talk about this existence, I will talk a little bit more about it later. What I'm going to mention are some nice properties of the resolution, which explain partly why this is certainly not always going to exist. It actually has really nice properties. In exchange, we get really nice properties. So what will they be? So the problem we had before was that x was too big. So now we're not going to have that problem. So first of all, in fact, rho is an isomorphism over the smooth locus. So we don't have the problem if you start out with something smooth symplectic, we're not doing anything to it.
Yeah? Is something minimal symplectic? Because, I mean, you can blow up symplectically.
So you could maybe clarify that you're talking about holomorphic symplectic forms here. It's a different category altogether, I think.
Ah. Okay, but what I'm saying is right, and this is true, right?
Well, you know, any y is even dimensional if as a real manifold.
Well, right. So when I said dim y is odd, I was talking, of course, complex.
Right, and it may well admit symplectic forms in the sense of symplectic topology, sort of real symplectic topology, but it doesn't admit holomorphic symplectic forms.
Yeah, I guess I needed to say that. You're right. Resolution of singularities is symplectic here. So x, so holomorphic symplectic, maybe I should say. So I'm only talking about holomorphic symplectic or algebraic symplectic in an algebraic setting. So this is an algebraically defined form. So using Kähler differentials, like D, some linear combinations of DFs, wedge DGs, or similarly where you could have in the holomorphic setting, they could be holomorphic. So this is a holomorphic two form. So it has to be complex dimension even in order to exist. Yes, and everything I'm saying is relying on that. You can take the condition just that x be symplectic as a real manifold is very weak from this point of view of a complex variety. Okay. I hope this won't have to be redacted now. Is everything okay? Okay. So rho will be nice, rho and y. So this is the first uniqueness, right? The first uniqueness will be if you're already starting with something smooth, we don't want to be able to do anything to it. That wasn't true before. Okay, but now let me give you something that's a deep result about how big this is. Rho is semi-small. So there's these works. These are works of Bezherkovnikov, Kaleda. I'm not going to be able to tell you all the references and everything. I'm sorry about that. Kaleden and Kaleden has proved things. So some of their results I'll be mentioning, and that includes the semi-small And so this says that what? It says that if we take x, we cross it over y with x, this dimension has the same dimension as x. Right, so what is x crossed over y with x? Of course, it sits inside of x cross x. Right, it's the things, the pairs, x, x prime, such that rho of x is equal to rho of x prime. Right. I am off. Okay. Right? So that's that. So that'll have the same dimension, i.e., if we look at the locus of y and y, such that rho inverse of y has dimension I, let's just say, this locus has codimension at least 2i in y. So we can't have fibers that are too large. So in particular, we cannot blow up a point unless the dimension of y is 2. Right? Because the fiber over a blown up point will have dimension equal to dimension y minus 1. And this is going to be of codimension. This is the fiber, and so this fiber will not have codimension, will have less than codimension 2 times dim y minus 1, unless y has dimension 2. Okay? So we can only blow up points, and more generally, and we can't blow up points usually, more generally we can only blow up subvarieties of codimension less than or equal to 2. Blow up along. So if you want to blow up along subvarieties, they better have codimension less than or equal to 2. So in the case where you have a surface, it's fine to blow up points. And I'm going to say that in just a second. And in general, you can blow up along codimension 2 subvarieties. This happens all the time. But you can't blow up anything else. So this is an example of how a thing can't be too big. Okay. All right, and now I want to say also another few words, if you know what they mean, that the in this symplectic resolution setting, y has rational and canonical singularities, if you know what those mean. If you don't, that's fine. This was Beauville pointed this out, I believe. So this is already a restriction, if you like, on the singularities of what? It can't be too complicated. So you don't always have a symplectic resolution. Okay. But when you have one, it has nice properties. Okay, so that's just a little bit of background. And now I want to get to an example. Again, this running example, I want to try to discuss it a little bit. Okay, so simplest example, which is something I feel like I'm talking about all the time. So we'll take x equal to t star p1, and we'll map it to y. And y will be, again, this thing I just mentioned. It's this cone. Let's say uv plus w squared equals 0. Okay? So this is a resolution of singularity. So there's many, many ways to construct this resolution. So the first way to construct it is we could blow up the singular point. So remember I said that in general we can't blow up points, except we have dimension 2. This is dimension 2, so we can blow up a point. And in fact, this resolves the singularity. If you just blow up that point, it resolves the singularity. And you can kind of see why that works. intuitively, because now this P1, that's the blown up thing, sits over that vertex, right? So this is the fiber, so it's good, right? You have a P1 that's blown up. So that's one way to do it. There's some more sophisticated ways to do it, though, which are very important. And all of these ways I'm going to say just now, in just a moment, I'm going to take all these different ways of constructing this. So this is the simplest example, and it's also an example that can be generalized in many different ways. So I'm going to mention all the different ways to construct this resolution, and each of these ways has a generalization where you can apply it also to different types of singularities. And then we get this whole family of interesting symplectic resolutions. So that's one way. Another way to do it is we can take x is equal to, so first observation, so maybe before I do b, I'll do an observation, that y is also isomorphic to two other things which are useful, c2 mod plus or minus identity. So this is equal to, so functions, if we look at c2 mod plus or minus identity, the functions on this guy, by definition, are equal to polynomial functions in two variables of even degree. So they're invariant under plus or minus identity. So that's equal to functions in x squared, xy, and y squared, which if you think about it, it's the same as the functions in u, v, and w, mod up to, not going to get quite the same equation I had before, but almost the same equation. It's equivalent. In this case, it's u, w equals v squared. Almost the same as what I had before. Yes. I think that's third or fourth time. There'll be around 10 to 20. Okay. Great. So UW equals V squared. So this is another way to do it, and there's one other interesting way, which is almost the same. So we have this observation, and then we also have another observation that Y is isomorphic to SL, nilpotent 2 by 2 matrices sitting inside of SL2, which is... So SL2 is a three-dimensional Lie algebra. We're going to... these are the traceless ones. So all nilpotent matrices are traceless. This is the traceless matrices. And why is that? That's because this nil, we call it nil of SL2, it's equal to matrices A minus A, B, C, such that the determinant is 1. A squared plus BC is 0, I'm sorry. Right? Nilpotent has to determine 0. So this is also, again, almost the same equation as we had there. Okay? So there's two ways to do it. So I had to do this observation in order to get further on the next constructions. So now I can get to construction, the second construction. So the second construction will involve this nil thing. So now we can look at pairs of a nilpotent matrix. Let's call it X, maybe. Well, let's call it A. And then a line, L, inside of kernel of A. So since it's nilpotent, its kernel will be non-trivial. We can look at a line inside of it. But for most nilpotent matrices, except for the zero matrix, the kernel here will be one-dimensional. So the line has no choice. So what we get is, so this will be x. And so x will have a projection to y, which is just forgetting that line. So then we'll map this down to A. Right? And this will be, of course, 1 to 1, except over 0. The 0 matrix, because then we have a whole P1. And there the fiber is P1 will map down to 0. Right? Because there we have any line we want. So that's a way of seeing it. And this is called the Springer resolution, by the way. This is called Springer for SL2. And I'll mention how that generalizes to any Lie algebra and just a bit later. It's almost the same thing. It's just you have a generalized line. Okay, so we got that, and let me just explain to you why this is T star P1 very briefly, because we have another projection onto the line So onto P1 is equal to a set of lines. And so this is how you see it. This is I star T star P1. This is just the projection as a bundle over P1. Okay? All right, so this is one way to do it. This is nice, very nice way. So now let me give you a cheap way to do it. So it's an observation I should have made before. So an observation I should have made before. So if x to y is a resolution, and y is affine, then y is just equal to the affinization of x. So it's IE, it's equal to the set of maximal ideals of global functions. If you look at the set of points, and then if you look at its topology, you can realize this ring as a quotient of some polynomial ring, and you get it as a variety. If a global functions is isomorphic to something and some number of variables mod I, then we get that XF is equal to the solutions of I in CN. Right. So you can always recover, if Y is affine, you can always recover it from X just by taking affinization. And that's just because this map is a birational assumption. So they have to be isomorphic over an open set, and because it's proper, we're using both proper and birational. Birational, we're using that it has to be isomorphism over the open set, and proper is going to then tell us that the functions on this thing are just the global functions on Y. Why do I need that?
Well, I mean, if you have you take log of a single point, you can see.
Right, but the global functions, you're not getting more global functions. So you don't have any global functions on the fibers of points because those are proper. So I think the fact that it's proper is saying that if you look global functions over the fiber, then that's going to give you just the functions on the base. Okay. But anyway, this is true. I don't think we need to do semi-small or anything like that. Okay, so. So, if, again, yeah, assuming it's affine. If we're assuming it's affine, then we get this. Then we get this effect. Okay. All right. Okay. So I mean, the affinization just means this spec thing, and because it's proper, we get that. All right. So, what is the point of this discussion, other than to confuse everybody? It's to say that Y is uniquely determined by X. At least in the affine case. In the affine case. Not, of course, in general, because otherwise you could take x equal to y. Okay, so therefore, for C, we can start instead with T star P1, and we can take its affinization, which, of course, is isomorphic to this nil of SL2. So it's this guy we had. So this is kind of a cheap way to do it, but you can do this with all the symplectic resolutions. If you know already what X is, you can just take its affinization whenever you're looking at Y affine. So this is one way to do it, and of course this is fine. You can compute this no problem, because what is this? It's going to be global sections of SIM over OP1 of O of 2, which is of course isomorphic to just functions, even polynomial functions. Well, this is spec of this. Okay, so it's easy to compute if that's the right thing. Okay. All right, what's another way? I'll give you one more way. We can take what's called Hamiltonian reduction. And that would be the subject of probably a whole talk in itself. But I just want to say that that given T star X and G acting freely, thank you, so EG, given T star X and G acting freely on X, then the Hamiltonian reduction, and there exists a Hamiltonian reduction, which is often there with three slashes or something like that, and this is going to be that isomorphic to T star of X mod G. So this is symplectic, right? So a cotangent bundle is the simplest example of something symplectic, and T star X is symplectic. So we've gone from something symplectic to symplectic. Of course, the dimension of T star of X mod G is equal to the dimension of T star X minus twice the dimension of G. Right? So you can think of Hamiltonian reduction as generalizing this simple example. What is Hamiltonian reduction? It's a way of giving a nice action called Hamiltonian on a symplectic variety by a group, getting some quotient of dimension usually less by twice the size of the group that will still be symplectic or close to it. Okay? So I don't want to define what it is. I just want to say that in this case, it's easy just using this example to explain what's going on here. We can take T star of C2 and we can mod it by this torus action where C star acts on C2 by dilation. Well, so now if we take C2 take away 0, then we would, if we modded this by C star in the obvious way, we would get P1 topologically, right? Right, if you mod C2 take away 0 by this, and even algebraically too, but I mean, let me just say topologically, you get P1. And so we expect that one way to take this quotient will get T star P1. So in fact, there are two ways, or at least two ways, to define this T star C2 mod C star. And so we get T star P1. This is the GIT way. You've heard of GIT, and we get this, if we take this the ordinary quotient, and we get nil of SL2. Okay? And this would be what's called the categorical quotient. So the categorical quotient is easier to define. In this case, it's functions on here, which are invariant under the torus. And for this GIT, instead of taking invariant functions, you take sort of quasi-invariant functions, you take a projective scheme of it, and you get this thing. Okay? So there's many different ways to define this resolution. And each of these ways, so what have we got here? Well, C is sort of cheap. I put that in the middle as a breather. That's taking affinization. That'll work, of course, in every situation, but you have to know what to start with. But these other ways that I was just talking about, the Hamiltonian reduction, the blowing up even though it seemed kind of dumb, and these pairs of points, very non-trivial business, these will all have generalizations to other varieties. So we'll blow up singularities of other surfaces, other quotients of C2 by finite groups. We'll take nilpotent cones and other Lie algebras, and we'll do the resolution like this. And also, this Hamiltonian reduction also can be generalized to many varieties. So I won't talk about it too much, but I am going to talk about it a little bit. All right, so those are the many different ways to construct it. And now that I've done that, and I also don't have very much time left. Actually, I was very slow. So maybe I'll just give you a picture here for what this all does for us. So what does this do for us? So first of all, I want to say, what is the uniqueness? So what is the uniqueness? So there's a theorem of derived uniqueness. This also is a work of Kaledin, but based on Bezukhov of Kaledin works. And it says that if we have two resolutions, x, y, x prime, right? So let's say rho prime and rho. Then, so it's not true that x is actually isomorphic to y, but we get a derived equivalence. Let's just say what in words of that is. dB of x equivalent to dB of x prime. So we don't get that they're actually equivalent, but we get this. So what is these sides equal to? This is equal to complexes of sheaves or vector bundles, if you like, on x, and similarly here.
Resolution here means symplectic?
Yeah, if we have two symplectic. Of course, this is not true in general. We don't have any sort of uniqueness in general. And you can see that when you blow up a point, there's not a derived equivalence. Right? Like I was talking about, you blow up a point in C2. But in this case, you have this, and in fact, this derived equivalence, so whenever if you ever learn anything or know anything already about derived stuff, then whenever you have a derived equivalence, that it always can be constructed by, at least if it's a natural one, and in some cases it doesn't, in all cases, whatever, you can construct this derived equivalence by a very nice construction. And in fact, the way he constructs it, so this thing here is given by, this phi thing is given by, essentially, is given by some bundle, some tilting, something called a tilting object, and so that if we take a complex on x, we want to take it to sort of the we want to call the integral over rho of x is equal to rho prime of x prime. So these are this was this equation for x cross x prime over y of so we have this f, which is a function of x, it's on x. We're going to tensor it by this guy e. It's a function of x and x prime dx. Right, so this is looking like a Fourier transform. Or in other words, in terms of algebraic geometry, we would take pi prime star of pi, all derived, pi upper star of f tensored with this e. Right, so there's this tilting object that Kaledin constructs, and it uses quantization of the resolution, which was the next thing I was going to briefly talk about. But so you get a really nice equivalence, so they're not exactly the same, but what it says is that cohomologically x and x prime are the same. So that's saying what? It's saying that, well, they're Hochschild, if you know what that is. Hochschild is the same. Extentor of f objects will be equal to this corresponding extentor of these phi of f objects, right? And then, okay, and then in fact, that the Ram cohomology is the same. This isn't actually obvious, but I believe that's also true, etc. Okay? So cohomologically, they're the same, and in many ways, from what we're interested in, they're the same. So I'm not going to hold you that much longer, but I needed to say a little bit about what this all relates to representation theory, and then a little bit about some conjectures in this business. So representation theory, we saw we had this T star P1 nil of SL2, this guy we had. And so now associated to a symplectic variety are quantizations. So in the affine case, you just replace OX by a non-commutative deformation. So if we're graded, let's call this A, then we could say that A is filtered. One way to do this would be say A is filtered, and Ger A is this OX. And then we're going to have a compatibility between the first order, the bracket on A, to the first order, and the Poisson bracket on OX from the symplectic form. So if you look at functions on any symplectic variety, you get something called a Poisson bracket on it, which is like it's a Lie bracket with additional, that's the derivation of each component. So you get this compatibility. So now the point is, so what's the point? If we take G is equal to a Lie algebra, finite dimensional Lie algebra, then we could take a G star as a dual, and then functions, and this is affine, functions on here are equal to the symmetric algebra of G. So there's a deformation of this. We get UG, so the enveloping algebra of G, and then UG is defined basically by the property that UG modules are equal to representations of G as a Lie algebra. Right? And so now, nil of SL2 sits inside of SL2, which is in this case, since this is, in general, if you have a finite dimensional semi-simple, this is killing form, which says it's isomorphic to its dual. And so now the functions on the nil of SL2 is equal to the functions on the whole thing, modulo a certain ideal, which is just setting the Casimir equal to zero. C is equal to the graded version of Casimir element. Right? And so we quantize it. We'll just be given by USL2 modded out by setting the Casimir equal to some lambda, i.e. USL2 modded out by the kernel of some central character. So we're going to be looking at all representations of SL2 where the Casimir acts in a certain way. So all representations of a certain central character. And so this quantization, through quantization, we've seen that the simplest example of symplectic resolution, its quantization gives you representation theory of SL2. And so now we just sketch how that generalizes. So if we let G be any finite dimensional semi-simple Lie algebra, then we have something called the Springer resolution, which is just like the one I described. So B is equal to the flag variety. So for GLN, it's complete flags in an n-dimensional vector space. And then we have this rho, and rho rho is the projection to the so if you look at the tangent space, you'll get a projection to a nilpotent matrix. So you can realize this also as a space of pairs, nilpotent element, and what's called a Borel subalgebra B inside of G. So I don't have much time, but and B will contain X. So then it will project it down to X. So you can have this generalization, and then just as I was saying before, quantizations of nil of G give you representation theory of G, and moreover, very useful, if you can use this rho, there's some deep theory that says that rho localizes the rep theory on this T star P, B. So EG, in the case, again, of SL2, P1 to the nil, we get that finite dimensional reps of SL2 are intimately related to sections of line bundles on P1. Well, we know that these dimensions are the same. Dimensions are 1, 2, 3. So you can make this more precise if I had another few talks, and then you could say that that by taking sections of line bundles, then you will get this, you will get the representations of SL2. So this is what happens with the quantization. Okay, so so this is sort of a generality in that direction. So if you don't know very much about Lie algebras, then I encourage you to not worry too much about this particular slide. But if you know a little bit about them, then what I'm trying to convince you is that this gives you a means for viewing representation theory of finite-dimensional semi-simple Lie algebras as included in the in symplectic resolutions, in some sense. And also this this localization theory. So there's something called the Balanz and Bernstein localization theorem, which makes this comment precise. Okay, so that's a little bit about quantization. I also want to point out that this quantization, and in fact, not just quantization, but in characteristic P, is the key to the proof of the derived uniqueness as well. That I mentioned, this derived uniqueness result of symplectic resolutions. Okay, so that's just a little bit about that. One other thing I wanted to point out, and that is that, I'll get to it in a second. So let me go back to this. So for those of you who didn't like Lie algebras, you're kind of a breather for the moment. So now I'm going to talk about finite groups instead. So now, blowing up construction of T star P1 to this, now I'm going to call it C2 mod plus or minus identity, which is one of the ways I have, generalizes. So we can look at gamma inside of SL2C, the finite subgroup, and then we can take C2 mod gamma, which is a sum singularity, and then you can blow up repeatedly, starting with the origin. And then you get something which is a resolution. And because this is a surface, because its dimension is 2, in fact, C2 mod gamma is the unique minimal resolution of singularities. And in fact, it's symplectic. It's not immediately obvious from this point of view why if you keep blowing up until you get something smooth, you'll get something symplectic. But from that other point of view I just got rid of for you with the Lie algebras, it is. Because you get this T star of B involved, and any cotangent bundle is symplectic. Okay, but anyway, we do get something symplectic, so this is one thing. And there's a nice classification of these groups. And I was just teaching this classification to my class right before this. The classification of these groups, and I almost asked them to come to this talk just because of that, but then I decided to spare them. The classification of these is, well, we have the cyclic groups generated by zeta and zeta inverse. We have the dicyclic groups, which is generated by this and also by this 90-degree rotation. And then we have the double cover of the rotational groups. I was actually classifying the rotational groups in my class because this is a standard thing to do in 373K. So double cover of tetrahedral, octahedral, or cube, and icosahedral or dodecahedral rotational symmetry groups. Well, of course, the reason why that is because this double cover is just using the SU2C double covering SO3R. So there's a spin group, if you like, spin. So this is 2 to 1. So, and this is the maximal compact in SL2. So you can look at every finite subgroup will sit inside here. Another way to say it is, and I'm going to explain this next class, is that you can, in my next class, I'll explain that you can always take in a finite group, you can always get a form that it preserves, and so it sits inside the unitary group. And therefore, if you have it sitting inside the unitary group and it had determinant 1, then it's in there. So you classify them in this way. Up to conjugacy. These are all these up to conjugation. Gamma equals. So I didn't really have to say, I kept worrying about this exact comment that you made just now. Do I have to say up to conjugation? On the classification I had for my class, I guess I didn't have to say it because I was saying that everything is a tetrahedral, octahedral, icosahedral rotation, but you don't say where that polyhedron is. So conjugation just rotates the polyhedron. So I never had to say it, but now since I wrote matrices, I do have to say it. Okay, so there's the classification. Great, so it's a very nice classification. And moreover, what is it I want to say? So there's something called Nikai correspondence. So this is the classification, so they're very nice groups, and now we have something called Nikai correspondence. It turns out, if you write the graph, vertices equals non-trivial, I'm going to discuss, of course, representation theory in my course very soon, non-trivial irreducible representations of gamma, of the vertices, and an edge to rho prime. So it's just the single edges, if and only if rho sits inside of the standard representation C2 tensored by rho prime. This is a symmetric operation because C2 is its own dual. Since gamma sits inside of SL2, since it preserves, since it has determinant 1, it preserves the determinant. Okay, so we get this inside of there, and then this is called the Nikai graph, so the classification, one way to classify, which is not the way I did it for my class, one way to classify the gamma is this, in fact, these graphs are the type ADE Dinkin diagrams. So we get this one for the cyclic group, AN minus 1 for the cyclic group N. We get this one. What did I do? So dn for a dicyclic group, since I'm writing this now, I don't remember exactly what the relation is between the dn and the tilde d. And then we get also these exceptional guys, e6 for the tetrahedral. Oops, I put one too many. Tetrahedral, etc. e7 for the next one and e8. Yes, thank you. All right, so that's that. And now here's the amazing fact which can be proved by realizing C2 mod gamma is sitting inside of nil of G, where G is equal to the Lie algebra, the simple Lie algebra corresponding to the diagram. It turns out you can realize all of these as sitting inside of here as a slice to a maximal a codimension 2 coadjoint orbit. An amazing fact is that that this resolution of singularities, we call this rho, we have rho inverse of 0 is equal to a disjoint union of copies of P1, one copy for each vertex, and they intersect if and only if the vertices are adjacent. So what this is saying is that this resolution is not just giving you representation theory of Lie algebras, but it's also giving us some representation theory now of finite groups inside of SL2. And in fact, this all generalizes. So I just want to make a very quick comment. So next week, and I need to stop too in just a moment. But next week, Gwyn Bellamy, in the same time, Bellamy will talk about symplectic reflection algebras. So what is a symplectic reflection algebra? It's related, it seems like I've completely changed the subject. But in fact, this is very related to what I was just talking about. So let me just call this SRA for short. So an SRA is equal to a quantization of this C2n mod gamma, so more generally where gamma can sit outside of the symplectic group. So I was doing the two-dimensional case. But now we can also, technically, to make this statement, I just said it's precise, we have to put in a word that's spherical. So there's something called an SRA, and then there's this subalgebra called a spherical. So a spherical will be a quantization of this, in the same way that remember UG mod the kernel of some character of the center was equal to a quantization of nilpotent of G. So next week we'll be doing this SRA. So now, therefore, the symplectic. So now I've just with this one comment up to the lecture next week, I've said that representation theory of symplectic resolutions includes not just representation theory of finite dimensional semi-simple Lie algebras, but also this SRAs. So you should definitely go to next week so you can see what something about these SRAs. Okay, so that's that. Now my final remaining time, right, I will discuss some a little bit more advanced things. So if you're definitely like had your fill, I won't be offended if you start to filter out. But let me just say a few more advanced things about all of this stuff. So what can one say? So there are some conjectures. So a geometry of symplectic resolutions and conjectures. So what we have is so there's this we can look at the Durham cohomology. And so there's a conjecture I've mentioned and talked before that I have with Pavel Ittinghoff, which says that this top cohomology is isomorphic to OY mod Poisson brackets. Okay, and now note that so this is relating, again, this is a strong relationship between this resolution and the singularity. Note that if Y, and we're mostly interested in the case if Y is a cone, so i.e., OY is non-negatively graded, then this gives H top of X a grading, which it didn't have otherwise necessarily, right? A grading. And this was just in single homological degree, this H top. And then we have a more general conjecture. H top means equal to the complex dimension. Because if y is affine, this was for y affine, of course. So for y affine, the top cohomology of a symplectic, if y were symplectic, this is a well-known result. And then the top cohomology of a smooth affine variety is always in dimension equal to its complex dimension. That's why this is the... So it turns out that's also the top dimension in general for the symplectic resolution of an affine singularity. Okay, and then we have also a generalization. So all the cohomology is isomorphic to some derived version. So this is called HP0 of OY. There's a derived version, HP dim y minus bullet of y. It's called the ram. Okay, this is a generalization. So this is one thing. Now we have another theory, and there's another version of this. It was very interesting. Nick Proudfoot posted. It's a recent preprint of Nick Proudfoot. Makes this a bit more interesting. And what is that? So it's saying that, in fact, H top of X should be isomorphic. Well, let me just say HP0. This HP0 guy I had here. HP0 of OY should be isomorphic to the intersection homology. Intersection cohomology of this dual singularity. So there's a theory which is not yet complete of symplectic duals. So given a cone, a cone symplectic singularity with a symplectic resolution, probably in general we'd like that, then we have this dual. So this is a Y, and we have this Y streak. And so Nick Proudfoot proved the conjecture, both conjectures 1 and 2. Let's call this conjecture 2. So in order to prove our conjecture 1, just this one here, he proved this conjecture instead. And then since he already knew... By computing HP0, basically. HP0 for when Y is a hypertoric variety. So in this case, the dual theory is well known. In this case, i.e., it's a Hamiltonian reduction. That's why I mentioned it before. It's a Hamiltonian reduction T star Cn mod C star M for some M less than N. Okay? It's just three slashes. And so, but what's the point of all this? The point is, one of the points of this is that IH is a graded vector space. The dual for this hypertoric case is what's called Gale duality of hyperplane arrangements. So they're both hypertoric varieties. Gale dual of hypertoric varieties. So in this case they get but in general the different examples that generalize what I was talking about before get interchanged in various ways with this duality. So these Nilpotent cone slices, you take the Langlands dual of your and you look at a sort of dual slice in there, and that's sort of duality there. And for these, I don't want to get into too much about it. But in general, when you don't take a hypertoric quotient, you take a different Hamiltonian reduction, then its dual won't necessarily be a Hamiltonian reduction, but will be something called a slice in the affine Grassmannian. But for this hypertoric case, that's what it is. But let me just mention a little bit more on conjectures, and I'll let you go. So what's else about these about symplectic duals? So there's a general conjectures So if you know what category O is, then one can define category O of a conical symplectic resolution with with a symplectic torus action. And then we get these category O of semi-simple Lie algebras, of SRAs, etc. And so the general conjecture, which they proved in many cases, of Braden, Proudfoot, Licata, Webster, they have these theories, and they say that this O of Y is causal dual. So this is an advertisement also for Hendrick's talk, I guess, on Friday, because he's going to talk about something, this causal duality, maybe not in this particular case. Category O of Y will be causal dual to O of Y streak. And they've proved this in many cases. Well, the original thing was for, again, this toric case with this Gale duality, but then I think they may have proved it in other cases. Okay, but so that's just some examples of conjectures, and there's many other conjectures one can talk about. Like one can talk about, so I mentioned how you have these different different resolutions that are all derived equivalent. You can actually piece them all together, and say that well, all of these different resolutions give you different quantizations, and the space of quantizations is parameterized by the second cohomology of a resolution, and then it's partitioned into these cones that correspond to different resolutions, where your quantization is just a quantization of that resolution. And so there's all this interesting stuff one can say, but I think that since it's lunchtime, I'll probably stop there, unless there's questions.
Is there some intrinsic way of talking about what kind of a symplectic form you have on a singular variety?
What kind of symplectic form you have on a singular variety? Yeah, I mean, not in general, because I mean, there's all kinds of things, but I mean, so first of all, when I said symplectic, so this is not a question, period. When I said symplectic, I meant smooth. I always meant smooth. But there is a notion of symplectic singular. It's a notion, which is very important, of singular symplectic. And by the way, this notion of singular symplectic is implied by exists a symplectic resolution. Okay. So this is implied by this. And what it means is that there exists, well, it means that for any, or equivalently, every, for some, or equivalently, every resolution of singularities, which need not be symplectic, x, y, then this means that, and so if you take a generic, the generic symplectic structure on Y, then call it omega, then rho inverse omega extends to a possibly degenerate 2 form on X. So I should have said singular symplectic means that first of all, Y is generically symplectic. I remember I said a long time ago that the simplest condition you would need would be that you would be generically symplectic. But this is a much stronger condition that for every resolution of singularities, if you pull back the form that's generic symplectic structure, then it extends. So this is a notion.
Sounds very close to Hartog.
Well, I mean, you could have poles.
Yeah, right. It's
so it's saying you don't have poles along the divisors.
But there isn't a, you know, there isn't a sort of test that you can actually do on Y that you can't sort of build some kind of a stratified symplectic?
Well, I mean, there are criteria, but a test, there are criteria, necessary and sufficient criteria, but not simultaneously necessary and sufficient. Right? I mean, there's some necessary criteria, and there's also some sufficient criteria. So you can build some symplectic singularities, and you can say in some cases there's definitely no, it's not a symplectic singularity. But I don't know how to say precisely, just in terms of the singularities of Y, whether it has this property. But like example would be this, if you take C2n mod gamma, in general, there does not exist a symplectic resolution. In fact, in a different talk, I mentioned some about there's some list that I'm trying to do with Gwynne Bellamy of all of the groups gamma that admit this, and basically they're all given by taking symmetric powers of the Kleinian singularities, except for two exceptional ones, and there's a bunch of things we haven't been able to check. But anyway, so in general, it doesn't exist symplectic resolution, but it is singular symplectic. Just because you're modding by a group action, and that Beauville explained, it's a simple construction. In this case, given a resolution of some variety, and then you have this quotient group action, then you can see that that this form pulls back, and the sixth form extends when you pull it back. I don't know if that answers your question. Maybe I don't have an answer, I guess.
Thank you for
this again. Thanks a lot.
That was great.
Thank you. So I will scan these and post them and send them to you also.
Yeah, well, no, I know, but